Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
This is NPR News. I'm Stephanie Curtis, sitting in for Carrie Miller. 30 years ago this month, a man named Tim Berners-Lee submitted an information management system to his bosses at CERN in Switzerland. He had hyperlinks in it, a standardized format, an interface that was user-friendly. CERN had a lot of information that they needed a lot of people to access, and this was a new way to organize it all. Berners-Lee invented the World Wide Web. That management system became the World Wide Web and the Internet. While that had existed before, it was the web that brought the Internet to our homes, our work, our phones, everywhere in our lives. There's no doubt that has changed our society, but has it fulfilled the promise that tech idealists had three decades ago? Today, we're going to talk about how the web transformed and didn't transform our lives. And also, what's next? Where will we be in 30 years? And what do we have to do to make sure we are happier with our tech lives in 30 years than many of us are now? Joining me now are two guests. Jason Hong is a professor in the School of Computer Science at Carnegie Mellon University. He studies the intersection of people and computers, and you're in Pittsburgh. Is that right, Jason?
Yes, I am.
Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Chaim Levkowitz is an associate professor of computer science at Kennedy College of Sciences. He studies web systems and mobile and cloud computing. He is in Lowell, Massachusetts. Welcome, Chaim. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
All right. We also want to...
Good morning. Just a correction. This is part of the University of Massachusetts.
Thank you. The University of Massachusetts, Lowell. Thank you for correcting me. We also want to hear from you out there. How has the web transformed your work, your personal life? And what else do you want from it that you're not getting? Where are the problems with it? Give us a call. The number is 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Jason, I'm going to start asking you a question. Remind people, there are people, I mean, the internet is 30 years old. There are adults who don't remember the world before the World Wide Web is 30 years old. What was the internet? What was our computer life like before the web became popular?
Yeah, it was a whole bunch of really difficult and arcane kinds of systems where you could still connect to computers around the world, but the interfaces were rather difficult to use. And if you rewind back, you had these computers that were really large. They took up your entire desktop. You had CD-ROMs that had encyclopedias on them. Graphics were rather primitive. So we had early kinds of forms of these online communities through what's known as these BBSs. So using modems and other kinds of things, but nothing quite like the large communities that we have today.
Chaim, do you remember life before the World Wide Web, and what were the things that were lacking in our lives at that point, and in our work, more importantly?
Well, I sure do. I started working with computers in 1972, way before the internet was a word even. To make a long story short, what the World Wide Web did to the internet is sort of what the GUI, the graphical user interface, did to computing. It democratized it. Prior to these, most people were afraid to get close because they didn't know the exact patterns that they have to type in order to get something done. Now it's all visual, and anybody who can point and click and drag could start interacting with information. What it really did is it democratized our consumption, but also our production of information.
How did it democratize? Who held the control over our information before this, Jason?
Well, it was primarily these large media companies. So if you remember what TV was like back in the day, there was, a few large kinds of stations and, major newspapers in every kind of city. And it was really hard to disseminate information back in those days unless you went through those major channels. But nowadays, anybody can publish a web page or a blog or also things like Wikipedia, where, you know, non-experts around the world can collaborate together and create these new kinds of web pages.
So it's easier for us to stay in touch. We all know that. As you pointed out, we're no longer imprisoned by shoddy network TV as our only choice of what to watch. I can get things shipped to me from around the country really easily. How has the internet transformed our lives in ways that we don't think about?
Well, positive and negative. Of course, you listed all those positive things, but it also encourages certain types of surveillance. It has created a situation in which anybody can find anybody, and that could be a wonderful thing, but it could only be also be a scary thing, depending on the situation. There's no such thing as a secret anymore. Now, that there used to be much secret in the past, but nowadays it just goes a lot faster than it used to. So everything is instantaneous, for better or worse.
Jason, what ways has the web transformed our work and our lives in ways that we don't see and don't touch necessarily, that have made our lives more efficient or better?
Well, there's a few things. So, you know, make it easier to find information. So, you know, with these Google searches, you now have, you know, pretty much all the information in the world available at your fingertips, which is really amazing. And it's also amazing that you can connect with people all around the world, too. So you can see new kinds of collaborations that are never possible. So there's these amazing kinds of YouTube videos, for example, of band members who are never even met each other face-to-face but can collaborate and create new kinds of music. And you can also learn from each other, too, in all these kinds of amazing ways, too. And the incredible thing is that it's sort of like an everyday phenomenon now that we don't even think of it as being magical. But back when these things first started, it was an amazing kind of experience to be able to connect all these people around the world together in ways that we have never been able to do before.
Anila in Minneapolis has called in. She called 651-227-6000, or maybe she called 800-242-2828. Our number is, again, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Hi, Anila. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
What was your question or comment?
Well, I wanted to piggyback off of what Jason was just saying. Back when I was 12 years old, I started pulling out my hair uncontrollably as what I now know is a coping mechanism for stress and anxiety called trichotillomania. But for 10 years, I thought I was alone and I was weird and I was very, very wrong for doing this. And it's only in my 20s when I was able to go to Google and say, why am I pulling out my hair, that I found it was a mental health condition. I found there was nonprofits out there to help people with the condition, and I really was able to start my road to recovery. And as Jason said, connect with other people around the world to share ideas and to share support.
What do you think you would have done if you didn't have those options of going to the web and finding stories? What would your life be like?
Honestly, it led a vicious cycle of negative self-speak. I was in a very deep depression at that time, and it saved my life, to be honest.
Thank you for calling, Anil. I'm glad that glad you have that community out there right now. Chaim, what did you hear in what Anila was saying?
I'm sorry?
I was just asking
I didn't
you.
I hear what you said.
I asked you, what did you hear in what she said? What stories does that remind you of, or what does that make you think about?
Well, actually, I was listening on the way driving to the office to some old song from the days that I was very young. And there was a reference there to somebody trying to find somebody and asking somebody else, try to find her address. And then the announcer said that she mentioned that to her six-year-old daughter. And the daughter said, why couldn't he just use WhatsApp or Google to do that? It's become very, very different. And for a lot of people who have never seen anything other than this, this is like Jason said, it's just the magic that happens. But a lot of different types of things that are now completely fluid and smooth used to be a major challenge on a very different platform. If you think about relatively modest means people's investment in the pre-online days, every transaction on the stock market could cost you $350 in commissions, which meant only people with seven or eight figures could even participate in that wealth-building capability. Nowadays, you've got places that allow you to do it for nothing or 20 cents. And this is just one example. There are so many other examples of different types of things that you either couldn't do or it was only limited to those who had significant means. Nowadays, it's pretty much democratized across the board.
Jason,
I always joke that if you can find anything that online technology has not touched today, I can guarantee you it will get to you tomorrow.
Jason, it's everywhere. All these connections are investing in the stock market is on my phone. My children have no idea what it'd be like to live without Google and be able to find someone's address if they meet somebody, they know how to track them down. Is there any way you said before the internet was invented, everything was in the hands of networks and gatekeepers, but don't we still have all those gatekeepers in the way? If I wanted to be able to just control my stocks and not have anyone have access to that information, it's really not possible anymore.
Yeah, what's happened is now there's just different kinds of gatekeepers. It used to be the case that it was, a lot of these large media companies, and to a large extent, they still have a lot of power over information flows. But now we have some new players like Facebook and Google, Twitter, and so on. And this is also leading to new kinds of challenges because it's transnational. So they have different kinds of laws that might need to be enforced in one location but not in other kinds of locations. Or there also might be issues with censorship. There also might be issues of deliberate disinformation campaigns as well, too. And so we're seeing the power of connecting people together, and we're also seeing a lot of the drawbacks of connecting people together, too.
Haim, what do you think that we could do about some of those drawbacks?
Well, I believe that we are the people who have created, meaning computer science professionals, have created the infrastructure that allows people to do these things. And we are going to be the ones who will have to come up with answers to some of these problems as well. We will have to come up with countermeasures that will continue to maintain our ability to access information without monopolizing it by anybody at all.
Is it a tech problem that we need to solve, or who can step in and help solve as a computer scientist? But do there need to be government rules, or do consumers just need to yell out for it? What do you think, Haim?
I usually prefer a solution that comes bottom up than top down. I'd rather see less government. I think there is a combination of technology, obviously. For example, there should be, and we will over the next decades develop countermeasures against in total invasion of our privacy, though privacy is a moving target. What privacy means to a 15-year-old is different than what privacy means to a 50-year-old. We will have to develop those technologies. We will have to have society understand the trade-offs, the implications of convenience versus, say, privacy and security. We will have to, obviously, here and there, enforce things via laws. All of them have to work together.
Jason, what do you think is the best way to kind of get some controls over our privacy again? Is it government, or is it just making the technology available somehow and having people adopt it of their own will?
Yeah, I've been studying privacy for about 20 years now, and it's sort of funny that all the things we've been warning about from the very early days are now coming to fruition in the bad ways that we didn't want to happen. a lot of us in the community used to research ways of giving more power to end users so that they could manage their privacy and so on. And I think a lot of us in the community have sort of shifted away from that trying to get end users, individual consumers, to manage their privacy is sort of hopeless at this point. The main reasons are that it's just so confusing as to where all your data is being collected and how it's being shared among all these different companies. And it's also not obvious that it's happening. It's happening behind the scenes as you're visiting websites or as you're using apps. And it's really impossible for a typical consumer. It's even impossible for us with PhDs to really understand all this, too. So I think that we really need to shift this burden over to more of the app developers, as well as having more government regulations to manage this. And I think, in particular, we've done a lot of these studies showing that app developers pretty much have zero knowledge of privacy. And so that's been a major thrust of our research, which is how do we help developers who want to try to comply with new kinds of laws like the European Union's GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulations, how do we help them do much better in their jobs? And I think that there is a lot of traction that could happen there. But it really is going to be something that requires a lot of these market, legal, and some technical solutions.
Efrain says on called in from White Bear Lake and said, what really changed is our access to the web, the way we used to access it was through portals on our desktops. Now we carry it around in our pockets. Bill also called in. He's standing by on the line. Hi, Bill. What was your question or comment?
Hello. Well, I would like to say I was a graphic designer back in 95, and I had the opportunity to design a website, which I hadn't ever heard of. And that totally changed my life by starting a web company. And I think to add to this conversation, it's provided opportunities for designers and other companies, not just to sell locally and do stuff locally, but really reach a broad audience. And so, like, if we have broadband and the web available in rural areas, people who were formerly isolated really now can connect and sell their visual art or their craft or whatever they're making really to the whole world, which was amazing to me back then and still is amazing to me.
Thanks for calling in, Bill. Our phone number here is 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000, or 1-800-242-2828. Now, Jason, you were saying that app developers need to be more informed about what privacy means. But meanwhile, what should we be doing as consumers? It's so confusing. Big tech companies, if you click through 5 billion pages, you can find where you can keep your information private. How can you get control over it? And what are the biggest areas, like what companies or what places are places where we lose control over our privacy?
Yeah, so to understand why these companies are trying to collect so much data, you have to understand what their business models are. And a lot of the business models of companies online and also some of these device manufacturers too is advertising. And so because they make money off of advertising, the more relevant ads that they can show you, the more money they can make. And the way that they can figure out which ads are more relevant is by collecting lots more data about you. So the kinds of websites that you're going to, the search terms you're doing, the clicks that you're doing on the websites. So given that, we have to look at what are some potential other kinds of business models that we as consumers have to start rewarding the kinds of web manufacturers or the device manufacturers that are having alternative business models that aren't purely advertising driven. So this might include things like, paying for apps. So those 99 cents or $5 for apps might actually be worth it in terms of privacy. It also means that you have to watch out for those kinds of TVs that seem to be really, really inexpensive, because it turns out that there's a lot of these smart TVs now that have microphones and cameras and are trying to collect lots of data about you, again, for advertising. So that's one of the big things I would recommend is we as consumers have to start trying to vote with our pockets. But on top of that, we also have to start trying to push our policymakers and our legislators to be a lot more aware of this, to start investigating these issues more and start coming up with better policies. Because, again, it's just too much burden on us as individuals. It's too hard for any of us to really understand all the amount of data collection that's happening.
Chaim, what would you recommend, since the original sin seemed to be set up in the mid-90s,
yes,
for us to?
I totally agree with what Jason said, that those are a little bit longer-term results. And immediately what people should do is start getting control of their technology to the extent they can. What I mean by that is I tell everyone who listens to me, When you start a new program, when you start a new app, go to the preference, first of all, and see what kind of controls can you apply. And you will be surprised how many times the default options that either a website or a program that you install or an app on your phone, their default options are what is to their benefits. But often enough, you want to do things differently, whether it's sharing data. Even they claim sometimes that share it with us so that we can improve our product. Well, maybe. But do you want to share it with them? You make the decision. There are a lot of places. 85% of the population will take any default option and never modify it. I try to almost brainwash my students, my friends, my family. Always go to the preferences and make sure that what they are doing is what you want them to do, not what they want you to do.
So if you download something, take a little bit of time and actually think about what it's doing and look and don't go with the default. That's great advice, Chaim. Let's go to Margaret in St. Paul. Hi, Margaret. What is your question or comment?
Oh, I wanted to comment on the fact that Skype has made such a difference for me. My daughter has been moved to the Philippines and has probably been there 27 years. And I used to call her maybe twice a year on her birthday or on Christmas, and we'd talk for 15 minutes, maybe, because it was so expensive. And now, of course, we can talk anytime. And I can see my grandchildren on the camera, and it's made a big difference. that's a positive.
That's great. One of our callers has a question for you. He's in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Thomas. Oh, Thomas dropped. So much for that. We'll go to Alicia in Farmington then. How about you, Alicia?
Hello. I just wanted to comment that I'm an online teacher in Farmington, Minnesota, and it's something that I never even imagined would exist when I got my teaching degree. But it's just amazing the way that schools, not only universities, but also elementary and high schools, have developed online and how we can reach students that might not be able to access classes for schedule or mental health or physical health reasons, that now we can help them from their home. I think it's a wonderful opportunity.
Did you teach in a regular classroom before this, Alicia?
Yeah, I taught for 10 years.
What is the difference in your interaction? Does it feel as fulfilling?
It's totally different, but it is like I have a very personal relationship with a lot of my students. They can text me problems. They email me problems. We meet online and I can help them. We have virtual classrooms where I can meet online and help students individually. Seems like I get a lot more individual help with certain students, depending on what they need.
All right. Thank you for calling in, Alicia. And thanks for doing the good work. Our phone number here is 651-227-6000. Jason, one thing that people really wanted the web to do is exactly what Alicia is doing, open up opportunities educationally, not just for rural America, but across the globe. Has that promise been fulfilled, and what else needs to happen to, is it going to be companies, or do there need to be nonprofits or governments working on that? Who needs to take control of that?
Yeah, we've seen some really amazing kinds of new kinds of sites in terms of education. So there's things like edX, Khan Academy, and even more, and new kinds of models of teaching, too. So just like Alicia was saying, I think the big thing, the big challenge that we've been seeing in a lot of educational technologies is what are the outcomes? So, you know, Alicia pointed out a lot of the positives, which is that, you know, people who might not be able to travel far or people who have to stay at home for a variety of reasons, you know, they can have a lot more access than they used to versus the traditional university model or the traditional school model. But the downside that we've seen, especially with these MOOCs, the massively online open courses, is that a lot of people just drop out, that there's not a lot of strong commitment. People don't necessarily get all the outcomes that they might get at university. You don't have a strong peer group as well, too. And so while we do have some of the benefits with these kinds of new kinds of media sites, we also are seeing new kinds of problems that we just don't know how to address yet.
Chaim, what do you think about online education and how it's changed teaching?
So we happen to have here a very well-known online program for information technology, which is a separate line within our computer science department. And as Jason mentioned, it has opened the door for a lot of different people who are coming from near and far. I think the comment about those MOOCs and those other branches of online education is missing one particular important component, and that is the difference between something you pay for and something you get for free. People who pay tuition, it doesn't have to be $60,000 a year. It can be a lot less than that. But when they start paying something, you see a lot more sticking with the program than a lot of those programs that you just join for free and I'm tired today, you drop out. So there are a lot of variety to this. I see a lot of people are now getting their own language tutors. Somebody wants to study Italian. They find somebody in Italy who's both fluent in the language and also is able to teach it, and they make a deal. And obviously, just like in any other type of a deal like that, maybe some people are more successful than other, but I don't think there is as much of a dropout as in those things that seem to be free. I can take it, and I haven't made any investment. It's funny that most people consider money more of an investment than time, even though money can be remade and time cannot.
Let's go to the phones. Al in Eden Prairie is on the line. Hi, Al. How are you this morning?
Doing great. Beautiful sunny day today.
It's beautiful out. I'm glad you're enjoying it. What did you want to talk about?
Well, I had a couple of comments. One was about, again, the free versus not free, but it kind of leads into the second question. I just picked up the show about 15 minutes ago, so I missed the conversation about things like Google and Facebook. And things, they're all free. And, you know, they have to pay for themselves somehow. But my thought is the competition, I would think the competition eventually, if people are truly serious about privacy, I had about 20-some years in the IT field, and I don't know, I'm kind of conflicted about this because people talk about one thing, but then they spend their money or act in a certain way that's contradictory to that. They talk about privacy somewhat being important. Again, it's generational, I do agree, but everyone to some degree cares about it, but yet they continue the activities. And I would think eventually, if it becomes a serious situation, that
all right, Al, you're breaking up a lot, and so I'm gonna have you just listen in, and let me ask Jason about that. Why that Al's point, and Hi mentioned this too. We download an app, we know there are privacy problems. Why don't we click through and read it? Why do we know that if it's free, you're gonna be sold advertising, or your information's gonna be taken and sold to somebody else? Why do we continue as consumers to just give away everything, all of our privacy?
Yeah, this is actually a well-known phenomenon in the research community. It's called the privacy paradox, and basically it's essentially what you just said. You know, we know everybody says that they care about privacy, but then when you look at their actions, it doesn't necessarily match everything that they said that they wanted. And there's several reasons for this. One is, you know, nobody reads these terms and conditions because there's a really clear cost, which is, you know, a lot of pain to read these long documents. So to give an example, I just recently checked the New York Times terms and conditions, and it's about 15 pages long. And there's also unclear benefit for reading these things. So is it actually going to help you at all? And in fact, you know, one of my colleagues did a back-of-the-envelope estimate, and it was something like it would take about 60 days full working days to read every single terms and conditions of every website you visited in a year. So obviously it just doesn't make sense. The other reason for the privacy paradox, too, is that there's sort of an immediacy. There's sort of the things I want right now versus things that you know are better for future you. But usually the things that are better for you right now, you know, sort of like the dancing dog, you know, the dancing bear, you know, people really just want to see that, and so they click on these things. So there's a lot of these kinds of studies trying to look at this, but we don't have a clear solution for trying to address it yet. But I also want to just end with one more statement here, too, about privacy. So there's this famous online saying that if you're not paying for it, then you are the product. So don't forget that you know, the people who are offering these free apps and free websites, they're trying to sell you, essentially, to the advertisers.
You know, it was Stuart Brand, wasn't it, in the mid-90s? He was the first one who said that information wants to be free. And so many people think it's like a Newtonian rule of physics, but it's not. How did it catch fire so easily? Why did that? Why did the everything being free take off? And instead of paid walls or being paying for things, Jason?
Yeah, I think that there's a marginal cost, which is that, you know, once you've written up your news article or you created some kind of picture or whatever, the distribution costs are zero. And so then there's sort of like this natural tendency to start pushing the actual cost down to zero because it's so cheap and people can find all these alternatives. But the problem is that once you hit that model, then it just makes it worse for sort of everybody, as we're seeing with newspapers and as we're seeing with classifieds and other kinds of stuff, that once you have this free model, that it really disrupts a lot of the old business models, for better or for worse. But then it also causes lots of other problems because, for example, nowadays, how do you find really great journalism online? It's really hard because there's no sustainable business model, and a lot of these newspapers are struggling.
Let's go to the phone lines. Someone whose work life has been transformed by the web is on the line. Dr. Laporte, hello. You are in Marshall, Minnesota?
Yes, I am.
And how's your work changed?
I've done this since 1976, in which case I had bookcases full of books and research. Now, those books are all gone, and I have a little smartphone or a desktop, and I have subscriptions. I don't do free stuff for medical, but I bring up a variety of apps that I've paid for that I use every day, every hour. What's the right dose? What's the right medicine? What's the right treatment for these illnesses? They're all changing, and my 75-year-old brain can't keep all that straight, but my PC can. And so that allows me to actually have a memory that's beyond my head. The other part is doing research. I used to get articles from the University of Minnesota. It'd take 3 weeks. You'd make a request. Now I can click on articles and read them in real time from anywhere. And safety. Some things you see that are really unusual, even as a family doctor. And sometimes it's hard to, what is this about? If you type good phrases at Dr. Google, Dr. Google will often give you the answers. It's like, what? I never thought of that. So you can do all sorts of academic stuff at your desktop. The other final thing is I teach family medicine part-time. One of the things I taught over and over was suturing, how to suture on a little sponge model. And I gave this talk, I don't know, 15 times, and you just get tired of it. And I thought, fine. I hired a wedding videographer in Marshall. I said, come and video this for me. Let's just put it on the web at YouTube for free. And people that want to learn that technique can just click on it. They don't have to come to my class. They can buy their own sponge. They can do it. And there's tens of thousands of hits on this from around the world. People don't even speak English from reading their comments, are using this information to learn how to do suturing technique. So, you know, the spread of information like that is stunning. I never thought that would happen.
Thanks for calling in, Dr. Laporte. It's a wonderful story. Haim, how has it changed? How has the web changed medicine and how we take care of our bodies? What did you hear in what Dr. Laporte had to say?
Well, as a matter of fact, I spent the 80s working at a radiology department doing medical imaging, and we were conjuring up at that time the possibility of remote surgery, but the infrastructure wasn't quite ready for this. But nowadays, a lot of these things are beginning to happen, and that's a major, major thing. If you live somewhere far away or you're stuck in a car accident or battlefield and there's no way to bring somebody to do a procedure on you, if they can bring the equipment and the person can do it from remotely, that's a major, major impact.
Jason? One thing that the doctor mentioned was that he doesn't have to remember everything. He can look it up. He can use his brain for other things. How has the web and technology changed how we think? Are people actually thinking in different ways?
Well, I can tell you one thing that's probably changed for everybody, which is a lot of this kind of bar trivia or these discussions of, oh, what actor was in that movie? Well, unfortunately, it used to be fun to chat about these, but now it gets shut down pretty quickly because someone just looks up the answer. but I think the really important thing here, too, is that, you know, we have lots of people who, with the democratization of information, can now look up their kind of symptoms, and they can see potential kinds of illnesses they might have. On the one hand, that's sort of good because, you know, people might be more informed about it. But on the other hand, that can also be bad because these people are not experts. They might be going down a rabbit hole, and they might become hypochondriacs or might also misdiagnose themselves too. And so this could also lead to lots of kinds of problems. And so I think a really important thing here, and this is also one of the big dimensions of what the future of the web is going to be like, is how do we combine people and computers together so that we get much more effective systems? So, for example, like, we need experts in medicine to be able to read all these things and disambiguate between what's good information and what's bad information. Because with this democratization of information, some of it is going to have, you know, poor quality control. So, you know, Dr. Lepore was talking about how, you know, he has this one suture video. Well, I bet there's probably a dozen other suture videos that might be a much lower quality. How does a person tell which one's good and which one's bad? So this is really a sort of the paradox that we're facing with respect to the democratization of information. Nowadays, everybody can become an expert quickly, but, you know, what happens if you're being fed bad information?
Let's go to the phone lines. Tony in Burnsville has a very concrete question that I think will help a lot of people. Hi, Tony.
Hi. Yeah, I was wondering, when I log into apps now, quite often they ask if I want to, and they almost say conveniently, log in with Facebook or with Google. And I'm thinking, I don't know how that's really any more convenient because I have to log in there. But I'm wondering what I'm giving up. And I tried to read the, you know, the long novel that comes with it, to the disclaimer. But I haven't found anything specifically, but I'm pretty sure I'm giving up some information from Facebook to that app, or from that app to Facebook if I log in that way. What's the real deal on that?
Haim, do you have an answer for Tony?
I say the real deal is it's a bad idea. It's a bad idea not just because you're giving information. There's sharing of information that's happening even if you log in with your own email and password. But the one bad thing that happens here is if somebody manages to hack one of your accounts, they got access not just to that account, but to anything else for which you have logged in with the same set of credentials. And they know that a lot of people prefer convenience over security. So if they manage to get into your Google or your Facebook account, they're going to start hacking all those other places and see what they can find just with those credentials. And Lord knows they'll find them.
Haim? Before we go, I want to talk about the future a little bit. What you see as the next leap forward? Is the next leap forward, is it just faster and faster speeds? Is it spreading access? What do you think is going to be the next thing that changes our lives and our work?
I anticipate, and I know that there's some work already being done, that what we now refer to a lot as artificial intelligence, and in my early years in the 70s, we used to call it a cheap substitute to the real thing, except it's not cheap. Today, it's getting to be a little bit more intelligent, and there are all kinds of efforts, some of which are going to be very good. For example, analyzing information to determine quality, what Jason was referring to. I think we will have better automated techniques that will allow us to find some ranking and some rating, just the way we're able today with search engine to get relevance ranking. I can expect seeing rankings of quality of information of various type. On the flip side, and I know there are already efforts to do this, certain entities are trying to develop the equivalent of a credit rating to assess your emotional capacity, your mental capacity, and trying to use that for a variety of reasons, whether it's to decide whether to hire you or not, or whether to decide what kind of political propaganda to push down your throat. Those are the things that we probably are not going to welcome so much, but rest assured that they'll be there.
Chaim, thank you for joining us today. I really appreciated it.
Pleasure being with you. Thank you.
Jason, same question for you. What's going to be the next leap forward? What do you think is going to transform our lives? There are a lot of people who still don't have the web besides really slow speeds. Is that it, or is there a bigger change coming?
Yeah, so the easy prediction are that things will get, you know, bigger and faster. But what I think is going to be a potentially tectonic shift for the technology landscape is what's known as Internet of Things. And this refers to this trend of computation and communication and sensing being embedded into our physical world. So it's no longer just virtual worlds where people can interact with each other, but now the computers are part of everything around us. So this includes things like smart toys, smart houses, smart cars, and so on. And I think this really does have tremendous potential for improving our lives in terms of healthcare and urban planning, transportation, sustainability even. But there's also going to be a lot of the same problems that we're facing too, so especially privacy. So I think that we're seeing this big kind of shift already. In Pittsburgh, we already have some of these autonomous vehicles that are going around. It's really cool. But we also had to be a lot more wary of what the potential downsides are. And, you know, we have a lot of those that are pretty foreseeable. So this includes things like, you know, what's going to happen with jobs as more AI and more of these kinds of automated systems comes out? What's going to happen to our interactions with other people? So I think, you know, there's this one phrase I heard from an economist that I really like a lot, that there's no solutions, there's only trade-offs. And so as we're trying to develop these technologies, let's be a lot more wary of what these trade-offs are and make sure we can maximize the benefits while mitigating a lot of the foreseeable downsides.
Jason, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Jason Hong is a professor in the in the School of Computer Science at Carnegie Mellon University. Let's let Stevie from Ada have the final word. Stevie, hi. How did the internet change your life?
Well, as a dog trainer, I usually work with humans and their dogs or other pets in person. Now I can meet virtually, and it improves some of the treatments that I can do with dogs. Dogs that have reactivity issues or separation anxiety, my presence changes their behavior. By meeting over an online platform, I can still talk to the owners, I can still see the dog's behavior, and we can get better treatments or outcomes, at least in the training.
All right. Thank you for calling in, Stevie. I've really appreciated it. The internet bringing you better behaved dogs.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to the discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet us at @CarrieNPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@npr.org.